and welcome to the Harvard Kennedy School Policycast. I'm your host, Togo Moyo. Joining me today are Kennedy School professors Matthias Rissa and Jacqueline Barber, both at the Harvard Kennedy School Carr Center for Human Rights Policy. Now, throughout history, governments have used crises to consolidate and cement power. Yet while some official actions like restricting movement, ramping up surveillance, curtailing freedom of assembly, and closing borders can be a cause for concern, they are also helpful when trying to manage and control catastrophes, such as the current COVID-19 pandemic. Professors Rissa and Barber say that while some of these measures may be temporarily necessary to prevent loss of life, safeguards must be put in place to make sure human rights are not eroded over the long term. In the case of the COVID pandemic, they say care must be taken to protect vulnerable populations who are most at risk, and that both the pandemic and the current intense focus on systemic racism and police brutality in America show the necessity of protecting the rights of all people. Professor Rissa is the faculty director of the Carr Center, and his work focuses on global justice and the intersections of human rights, the climate crisis, inequality and technology. Professor Barber is an expert in public health, particularly involving children and vulnerable populations. She's also an internationally known human rights lawyer and a lecturer at the Harvard Law School. Welcome to Policycast, both of you. So you're both scholars and researchers in human rights. And as you think about the pandemic and you look at the moment that we're in America, what are the sorts of things that you're thinking about? Let's start with you, Matthias.
So I'd say this is a very striking moment in American history, really striking writ large. Both the pandemic and the protest that resulted from the death of George Floyd really point to a lot of underlying vulnerabilities and inequalities, as you said. And they don't only bring to the fore that people are differentially affected by both public health issues and by the potential of state force to turn violent and not live up to the task for which it ought to be designated. But it also really brings to the fore these different underlying narratives about this country. I think one reason why people are so angry right now is because there is just such a lack of willingness to actually talk about American history. And, you know, we're getting drowned in this rhetoric of glory and make America great again. And so America was great and was only great. And you know, not that I personally would want to deny that America has many great things to show for itself, but there is a variety of narratives. There is a very complex history in which some people have lost out dramatically, beginning with Native Americans, African Americans, you know, who were brought here in China. The Native Americans who were subject to a genocide, just white people making clear that they wanted to be certain places and wanted certain services, and they just basically just made it happen no matter what happened to other people. And there's an unwillingness to talk about that. There's an unwillingness to reckon with the past, and that brings people to the street. At the same time, when we are also seeing the consequences and the phenomenology of the underlying injustice manifest itself in the pandemic. So it's really a striking confluence of all these underlying weaknesses from a social justice standpoint that are so characteristic of this country and that many people are just so unwilling to even address.
So Jackie, let me come to you. So you focus on international human rights primarily. As you look at what's happening in the US, what are you thinking about in relation to human rights, but also the pandemic that is a constant in everything that we're seeing with regards to the protests that are going on now in the United States and around the world?
Togo, I think I'm seeing at least three things. First, I'm seeing how structural racism has really manifested itself, if you like, this spring and summer in America, for all to see, which so many people had not been aware of before, surprisingly. It's really the point Matthias made. So it is surprising that given what we know about dramatic racial inequality in America, given what we know about the ongoing legacy of slavery, I would say, it is surprising that this isn't an acknowledged fact. It's surprising that the disproportionate impact of COVID on people of color, African Americans, Hispanics primarily, took people by surprise. It's odd. It's very surprising that this should not be an acknowledged fact about America, like it was an acknowledged fact about apartheid South Africa. Nobody denied it. Some people might have said it was the right thing to do, but nobody denied it. So I think that's odd. That's really surprising. That's my first thought. My second thought is that this really shows the urgency of reparations. I do really think that reparations for state harm are urgently called for, both for slavery and what happened after the end of slavery, but also for a series of other major state injustices to do with colonialism and so on. And we have a book coming out, which I've edited together with three other colleagues here at Harvard, which is called, entitled, A Time for Reparations? And it'll come out this fall. So that's the second thing I think of. I think that reforming the police, instituting new regulations, getting rid of chokeholds are all very overdue reforms, but I think they are really small fry compared to the systemic issues that this country is facing. In a way, you might say police brutality is nearly an epiphenomenon of underlying structural racism, because African Americans in this country are targeted because they're poor, because they're disproportionately in congregate settings, because so many things are come together. And so police brutality is one of them. It's not a coincidence, though. It's not an aberration. It is not a few bad apples. So that's my second thought, that we really need to now push on with this discussion about reparations and think what reparations mean. It's not an easy discussion. There's not a simple way of fixing things by, obviously, it's not a question of making individual payments to individual survivors, though that may in some cases help. It's much more about thinking about how a national GDP is distributed more equitably across different communities. Third thing I would say is that through this period of real darkness for many months, you know, with an administration that surprises us every day by an even more obscene set of positions and comments, and then an illness that has been terrifying and has taken such a heavy toll, it is also a moment of hope. It's a moment of, I feel, optimism about this country. And I agree with Matthias, there are many things about America, both he and I are foreigners, there are many things about America which are admirable, but there are many things which certainly from a European perspective are also surprising and dark. And this moment of seeing so many people, young people, people of color, but also people, white people and middle-aged people coming out with this outpouring of anger and dismay has been, for me, has been very encouraging. So actually, I would say that my mood has significantly lifted despite the horror of the killing, despite the anxieties about the pandemic. My mood about the political future has actually lifted, and I feel very inspired by the courage actually of so many people, you know, despite the fears of the pandemic, to come out, you know, carefully with masks and social distancing as much as possible to make their views known. So those are my three reactions.
And I think you've both raised some really important points that I think are part of the conversation right now. I mean, Jackie, I'll just jump on the most sort of recent thing that you said about reparations, the issue of defunding the police, et cetera. I think those are all big issues. And I think one could actually have very interesting podcast discussions about each one of those ideas that speak to the systemic racism here and some of the sort of practices and policies that have led again to this moment in America where you're seeing riots, protests against injustice, and a sense that there's been an inadequate response. But I think we should probably keep this podcast fairly focused on the issue of human rights and the pandemic and explore some of the sort of broader issues around that, even as we know that there's quite a huge moment in America now. And so my next question will be around, how do you actually get people to focus on human rights during a pandemic, when the nature of a pandemic is that you're fearful for yourself, you're fearful about the public health issues? How do you bring that angle of human rights into the conversation?
Yeah, so let me maybe start by saying one thing that I think is so horribly so horrible about situations of pandemics is that basically everybody, you know, people you encounter on the street, people you see around, you easily actually stop seeing them as human beings in their own right and with their own standing, and you mostly see them as potential containers of a disease, right? And that is what is so horrifying, right? About, especially if you think of pandemics with a much larger mortality rate than this one, and that particular regard is even worse than warfare. I mean, not that warfare has anything going for itself, but at least in warfare, somehow people are making decisions, right? And you can kind of come to an understanding with people. They are making choices and you can reach them, right? And here we're all kind of fading away into some kind of a bit of nature that comes with viruses, right? And we are trying to navigate around each other. And I think that has a substantial potential for really dehumanizing human interactions quite dramatically. And it really is a time where we just have to constantly remind ourselves there is a person, there is somebody with a story, there is somebody who has a future, hopes to have a future, and that standards of human dignity that have been so difficult to come by, hard won over the decades and centuries, that right now, you know, in spite of all the precautions we need to take, they really matter. And I think that's in a way a key thing we need to remind ourselves and each other. We need to be reminded by our leadership that it's in times like these that human dignity really needs to come into its own.
And Jackie, give me an example of some of the things that you're concerned about, as Matthias says, that start to emerge, sort of dehumanizing of people during a pandemic. What are some of the things that we're seeing that we need to be aware of?
I think we're seeing lots of examples of this kind of fear of contamination by the other, as if the other, nearly by definition, is somehow a polluter. We've seen this in the context of borders, which I know we'll talk about more. We've seen this in the context of stigmatizing already stigmatized populations. So in Europe, for example, one of the largest groups of stigmatized populations still kind of very accepted is the Roma population. And we've seen an enormous resurgence of vicious hate speech, not only hate speech, but hate acts, hate crimes against Roma people, simply as a kind of catalyst for the fear and the hostility that people feel, which is exacerbated and multiplied in a time like this, where people's levels of anxiety about the unknown are heightened. But Tomofu, I just wanted to go back to the question that you asked Matthias, which is, how do you get people who are, you know, inclined to be very self-focused at a time of danger to think about others? And I think that the two answers that I would give. One is, I would give a very pragmatic utilitarian answer, which is, if you don't care about others, you're really reducing the risks of your own safety. Because even though we know that this disease has a greater impact on some parts of the population than on others, contamination can spread to anybody. And so if you don't care about certain populations and you think, well, they don't really deserve information, they don't really deserve access to healthcare, you are increasing the body of contaminants in your own societies. So there is really a utilitarian argument for just saying inclusion is a healthy measure, I would say. That's one point I'd make. The second point I'd make is that nearly every family has someone who is an other in it. Whether it's an elderly person in a nursing home, whether it's a person with a disability in a mental institution, whether it's an immigrant, a foreigner. So any attempt to really exclude whole big chunks of the population is likely to rub up against some people who are in your own clan. And so I think those are two reasons why you might be able to appeal to a greater sense of inclusion amongst people than we otherwise have. But I do think Matthias is absolutely right that this is a critical area for leadership. Maybe that's one of the few ways in which the analogy with war works. You need leadership.
So I think part of the challenge has been that this idea of excluding certain people or being fearful of certain people seems to fall into the idea of protection. So for instance, I know there's been reports or cases in Africa of Chinese people being targeted, as in, you know, this virus, and we've had leaders say this virus came from China. And so people see it as a public health response to try and close off people from China. And similarly in China, you've had Africans being treated badly for the same reasons. So I think part of the challenge is, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that some of the messaging around how you respond to the pandemic by sort of closing off and isolating does seem to give almost a credence to this idea of some people are more dangerous. Matthias, do you want to say anything about that? I know it's about leadership, but I'm curious to hear what else you might want to add.
Yeah, so it is about leadership. I mean, I'd rather not bring the leadership in connection to the war here. Right? There's been some interesting reflection also in some op-eds and some studies about how especially countries led by women, some of the countries that have been quite successful at dealing with this phenomenon so far, like Germany and New Zealand, countries led by women have avoided that rhetoric altogether. And, we find this, coming from Trump, of course, and Macron also, is big on the war thing. And I think I see the connection to leadership, but I think what the talk to war, I think about war mostly does, it's creating this us versus them, and them, and I mean, the way we understand war, them is other humans, right? Them, and so, and this would actually be, I mean, a global pandemic is like the premier opportunity to say, look, there is actually a common enemy here, right? This goes after, and not just to kind of say this and make it sound like the other is disagreeing with it, but just like the president unfortunately does, but really just to say, we can pool resources here. We have a lot of great researchers across many countries here, a lot of capacities, and we're not going to, in a way, this is kind of a writ large version, a global version of what Jackie was saying about the clan, the family context. We're not going to have a flourishing economy at the global scale in an era of globalization when countries are not, when they're not all up and running, right? We need them all up and running. And so we need a sense of leadership that says this is a moment for humanity to really pool its resources. Practically speaking, we'd need a lot of phone calls among leaders, a lot of networking among disease specialists, just a lot of communication and a lot of appeal to saying this could be a fine hour for humanity rather than a moment of divisiveness with finger pointing. I mean, really, who cares where it started? We have it now.
And humanity isn't really rising up to the challenge. In fact, Matthias, you've written that when we look at governments, that every day during this pandemic, governments around the globe are absorbing more powers. And, there's a real possibility. And I think we're seeing some examples of abuse of power. Can you give some examples of places in the world where you're seeing this happen?
Well, two examples that come to mind immediately, of course, are Hungary and China, right? So Hungary, this has been going on for quite some time, that Viktor Orban and his parties are basically seizing every opportunity to assume more power and ever more uncontrolled ways. And so Hungary is one example, the one that I worry substantially more about because of the enormously larger technological capacities involved, there is China. Yeah? So China has surprised everybody in the last 5, 6, 7 years anyway by building this massive surveillance system for a population of what, upwards of 1.4 billion that they managed to impose control mechanisms on them in order to consolidate the rule of the party is truly astonishing. And they have now been going through a period of compulsory digitalization currently, right? Sped up compulsory digitalization. And in China, they have really seized the moment to control the population yet more tightly through the utilization of health data. And I think this is there is a truly Orwellian scenario on the radar here in terms of the kind of access and tracing capacities that the government exercises over its people, which could really be done in completely different ways, right? It doesn't have to be done this way. But China, I think, is really a scary example of government usurping power through technology.
But how do you do it differently? Because one of the hopes that people have right now for actually getting control of this pandemic is the use of technology, being able to use technology to do the contact tracing, to do the monitoring. So how do you do it in a way that respects human rights and privacy of people?
So in the European Union, there's a lot of thinking around that also going on right now. And as you probably know, the European Union is much more preoccupied with protection of privacy and data. There's been a lot of legislation in different countries and also at the EU level itself. And so they're taking this very seriously for good reason. And in terms of this particular technological issue, so basically For tracing, I mean, if it's just about tracing, right? So the immunity passwords would be a different thing if you need to connect health data to particular people. But tracing can just be done if your smartphones know which other smartphones are around, right? And so suppose I'm getting the news that I'm infected today and I was out and about yesterday. My smartphone through a particular app would have registered which other smartphones were around, which can be done without connecting them to particular people. Then these smartphones would be getting notifications once I provide the information that I'm infected, right? So in this way, there would be kind of peer-to-peer messaging that is going through the smartphones and that would not involve any governmental data collection. So there are ways of doing that.
And so your concern is around the data being collected and held by government, less the technology actually collecting that data for the purposes that it's intended.
Yeah, the concern is that government is using the opportunity to deploy technology in the enhancement of its powers rather than in the enhancement of public health, right? Whereas smart minds should be reflecting more about how exactly technology can be used here for the public health benefit without channeling such possibilities to government.
And I want to keep on this just for a little longer, because I know in the US, just after 9/11, Congress passed laws that gave sweeping powers around surveillance. And again, that was done in the interests of safety, so sold to the American people as this is one way that we prevent something like this happening. So I imagine if we had a representative from the Hungarian government or from the Chinese government, they would be saying that all these measures are being taken primarily with the concerns of the citizens in mind. At which point do we become suspicious that, yes, that's true, but this is going overboard? And it may be repeating some of what you've said, but I do want to bring in the counter argument that some people may feel safer knowing that that data is being collected. How do we address it? And Jackie, feel free to jump in as well if you want to sort of comment on that as well.
Well, maybe I can just say that I think that, you know, government is a big box and there are good governments and bad governments. There's central government, there's state government, there's very local governments. And I think there is a case to be made for a role for government where that government is embedded in trust, community trust. So I think there is an opportunity here for governments actually to get this data, the tracing data and other data, and use it to understand, for example, which messaging techniques by authorities work better to get people to stay at home or to socially distance, and which messaging techniques work less well. So there's a lot, of course, of positive outcomes we can derive from data. The question is how it's used and how we as citizens feel about it. So I think that, you know, Matthias's example of Hungary and China really identifies two countries which have extremely authoritarian governments in a whole range of different domains, and where there are certainly broad sections of the population who don't feel that sense of trust. If you switch gear to countries like, I don't know that much about New Zealand, but Germany, for example, now, I don't think that Germans feel that sense of lack of trust. On the contrary, I think they feel very proud of a government that has been science informed on a daily basis, that has been completely transparent, and that is really trying to use data in a forward-looking way. The same, I think, can be said for another government which has a very senior female leadership, and I take Matthias's point about women leaders, which is Kerala, the South Indian state of Kerala, which has done incredibly well and which has actually kind of used very aggressive testing and tracing to contain the virus. What's interesting about Kerala, of course, is it's a state embedded in a country where the opposite been true, where there has been a real abuse of power, where the lockdown has been used in a very authoritarian way, some say nearly like a death sentence. So you can see within a government, different governance entities behaving differently. So in the Kerala context, I think people feel safe, just like maybe some people did feel safe in the 9/11 context. The onus is on the authorities to be transparent about how they are generating safety. So if they say, well, we're generating safety by using scientific data to understand better XY aspect of human behavior. It's very different from saying we're using scientific data to go after these miscreants or to go after these illegal immigrants, you know.
And how do you think about this in the context of people who'd argue that, you know, this is an emergency and right now the focus has to be in doing whatever it takes, however it takes, to sort of control this, and we'll come to the human rights privacy issues later. Could that be a valid argument? How would you respond to that?
Maybe I'll just say something first, and then Matthias, I'm sure we'll have useful reflections in addition. My point is that if you don't have trust and if you abuse people's sense of their own self-worth, you're going to be undermining the collective effort that we need to really address this issue sensibly. So if official messages become suspect, and we see this in the US, how the messaging has been very unsuccessful. And we see now kind of mixed messaging about whether you can open, whether you can't open. Different people are doing different things. If you're not establishing a consensus about the legitimacy of the message, built on people's sense of being respected and being treated as dignified beings, your ability, I think, to control social behavior and to change social behavior is going to be severely impacted. So, for example, if you say to the poorest of the poor, you know, you have to exercise a kind of total lockdown because it's in the interest of everybody to prevent social contamination, and you don't provide food and you don't provide shelter and you don't provide access to healthcare, you're going to generate a reaction which is actually going to be deleterious for the whole society.
And Matthias, you wanted to add to that?
Yes. I mean, in terms of the emergency, I think it's just maybe in terms of your question, Toko, so what if somebody says, well, there's just this one thing that matters right now? So I think that's possible, and you'll find some historical examples where it somehow would make sense to say there really is only this one thing that matters and everything else just really, you know, needs to be very single-mindedly aligned behind that. But normally, I mean, politics under normal circumstances and even emergency time politics is rarely like that, right? Of course, you have challenges that need to be mastered. In this case, you know, we need to deal with the virus. But you know, there's always a complexity of issues. And you know, Jackie's absolutely right. It lies in the nature of this effort that people need to be moved along. They need to comply. That means they need to understand. They can't be alienated from the process. They need to get what is required. And that automatically means we're not just going after one thing, right? We're not just optimizing on somehow getting these numbers down, focusing just on that without looking at what's happening in society, because that's kind of self-defeating, right? So single-mindedness here is self-defeating for the reasons that Jackie mentioned. And I also, as a German citizen, I appreciate, of course, Jackie's reference to Germany here. I think it is actually really quite striking, the high level of discourse there, you know, the high quality of discourse there, the way the government was communicating with the citizens, the way the government also made clear everything depends on compliance of the citizens, the way the scientists were involved by providing information, while it was also always clear that politicians are making the decisions. So all that also, I think, allowing for a lot of dissent coming in, right? Of course, there's different views about what to reopen, how fast, and all of that. So there were ways of doing that. So I think actually in Germany, by and large, you know, democracy is emerging strengthened through this. And there's other countries one could think of here, but I'm afraid in the United States, it's not like that.
And, you know, when you look at this, you almost wonder that, you know, when we talk about trust and we talk about, you know, sort of advancing democracy during this period in some countries, it almost makes you wonder if this pandemic isn't sort of exposing weaknesses that existed before, you know, sort of in your work in human rights. I mean, that's being laid bare. Would you agree with that? And do you want to just say a bit more about that?
You know, a few weeks ago, we came to a point where one quarter of all known, all recorded corona death cases were American, right? One quarter. But now actually the share is higher, and a disproportionate share of those were minorities, right? Which indicated the extent to which all sorts of social vulnerabilities, what kind of jobs people do, where they live, what kind of medical preconditions they have, all of that factors into this. And, you know, one thing that really kind of scared me then when I reflected on this number, one quarter, which is really a stunning number, one quarter of all recorded death is American, right? And is that this number, one quarter, we are also familiar with from a different context, namely one quarter of all people who sit in a prison anywhere on this globe sit in an American prison. And again, the same fact is true of of that number also, that a disproportionate share are again minorities, people of color. And then, you know, then if we have, I mean, we have these stunning numbers, and obviously that this is one quarter in this case, in that case, there's no magic here. But I think one needs to take a big step back from that and say, what is with the overall health, and just broadly conceived, the political health, the social health of this society, given that we are doing so poorly by these global standards, you know?
Well, I was just going to completely agree with Matthias and add just some specificity. So according to a recent piece that some colleagues of mine wrote, whereas 13% of Americans are African American, 30% of people who have been hit by the coronavirus are. So it's like over double what you would expect in terms of the population ratio. And there's a similar, not quite so dramatic difference for Latinos. So I think your point about pre-existing inequities and how in a way COVID-19 acts as a magnifying glass is very well taken. I think the other point though is people in institutions. Just mentioned prisons. Also, of course, the elderly, the very poor levels of care. I mean, of course, we know elderly people are more susceptible to the virus, but the disproportionate impact on elderly people in institutions, I think, says a lot about how, as a, talk about the States, as a rich society, we deal with some of the most dependent and vulnerable populations. And so this really does shine a light on issues of inequity, injustice, and misallocation of social resources, like I think few other things have in my lifetime.
And so let's talk about what would the policy response be? Because you know, you're not arguing that individuals or the market come up with solutions. You're saying there's definitely a role here for policymakers to be intervening here. So what would those policy responses be?
I would start with two points. One is the imperative of an inclusive message. And this goes back to the point about leadership. I think it's very important to have messaging, public messages from leaders at all levels, emphasizing the value added of including everyone in the access to the response, not stigmatizing, not excluding some populations. That's the first thing. And the second point I would make is that I think decentralization and community level impact is the name of the game. This is a global pandemic, but the most effective responses are going to be heavily contextualized and local. It's not one size fits all. And so, you know, we talked about Germany. You do have to target the quarantining. You can't, I mean, imagine if we had said everybody has to stay at home, even health workers, even food shops. You know, we haven't done that. So we've had some very minimal targeting, but we need to have much more targeting. And there are some issues which the science alone will not help us with. What do you do about schools? Parents can't go back to work if kids are at home. And now this evidence is emerging that maybe there's some, we thought kids were, you know, hyper-protected. And now in the last few days, there are these scary stories about a particular form of the virus, which has a very serious, apparently not lethal, generally, impact on children. So these are political decisions that communities have to be engaged with. So I think I would say that you need to have very strong democratic fora for discussing complicated issues, because science alone can just guide, but it cannot decide.
And Matthias, what's your sense in terms of the types of policy responses that you think are going to be more important in this moment?
Well, everything that Jackie said, I would totally underline, of course, myself. I mean, just in a somewhat more, you know, what kind of needed hands-on to get a grip on that, I think we just need to substantially build test capacities, right? So, you know, we need to have reliable ways. So actually, to go back to the German case for a moment, they say every day on German television, you hear now this number, the what they call the R value, the reproduction rate of the virus, right? Which is basically how many people one infected person is infecting, right? And you want this to be below one so that then, you know, the disease is kind of in decline, right? And so having a number like that means there is a substantially high quality statistical understanding of what you have, right? And you can get to that only if you have widespread enough testing to come to a data situation like that. So we need to come to an understanding like that. We need to have a statistical grip on the situation. And then we need to find ways of kind of targeting particular people. finding ways of tracing others so that when people are diagnosed, they can be traced. And we need to have an infrastructure in place, a support system in place, which means here at the state level, a social policy system in place that allows people to actually exit the workforce for a certain time without fearing that they were suffering any kind of disadvantage, right? And there needs to be broad support for all of that, right? So these are the kind of public health measures that we need, but that is really in a way the hands-on version for what Jackie so aptly emphasized as this message of inclusion, right? This really is something, also really going back to a point that Jackie made at the very beginning, right? We need to understand that, this is a problem that each of us will have as long as everybody else has it, right? And so we just need to really, it's a classical problem where we need to work on this together and create a sense of we are in this together.
Terrific. Just a really fascinating conversation. Thank you so, so much, both of you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you'll join us for our next episode. And if you'd like more information about other recent episodes or to learn more about our podcast, please visit us at hks.harvard.edu/policycast.